we should have the A-10 amendments should be before you. We had a discussion earlier this week about the use of statements that are made in a stalking order hearing, and these A-10 amendments reflect, I think, what the chair wanted on that. Briefly, the first part of the amendment deals with something that the juvenile department wanted. I don't know if Mr. Snyder's here, but this adds juvenile county department employees into the stalking order that says that you can't get a stalking order against someone who's in their official duties, basically, and you know, is supposed to supervise you. So that is an addition. And then on page three, line 15 to 18, when we had this bill the other day, the bill would have prohibited a district attorney from using statements that a respondent in a stalking order petition made in the case in chief or impeachment. This changes it so that the statements cannot be used for case in chief, but can be used for impeachment. That means if a person makes a statement in a stalking order hearing and you have a tape of it, or you have a witness who heard it, and then they make a statement at a trial that is inconsistent, you can use that prior statement against them to impeach them. That's what the amendments do. The reason they're so long is Section 2 deals with, again, stalking orders that are issued under a police citation. Section 3 deals with stalking orders that are issued under the Chapter 30 normal civil complaint type mode. So that's the A-10s.
Okay. Can we the A-10 amendments? Tell me if anybody has heartburn over it.
I guess I could look at them for a moment.
Okay. I know the DAs are having heartburn, but
okay.
All right.
I'm all right.
Kelly Sky. Are the criminal defense lawyers okay with this change?
I'm thrilled.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, it was the defense attorneys who got the original amendment to prohibit the use of these in a later criminal prosecution.
Right.
When they got them initially drafted, it would have kept impeachment statements from being put into. The chair had a discussion with him, and his understanding was that they were only going to do it for the case in chief. So I think this is.
And the issue was we didn't want to provide immunity for false statements given.
Right. I see my notes here now. So
if they changed their story later, then that can be used and we should still send it.
Okay. I'm fine.
Ms. Sugar, I know you dissent, but I'm not going to allow you to come chatter too much. Okay.
Can I ask one question?
Can you ask one question? Of course you can.
Chair. My concern is that in the prosecution of a, for example, a perjury charge based on those statements, that this not limit the ability to use those in the case in chief.
And Mr. Chairman and committee, and for the record, thank you for bringing that up. I think if you look at the language of lines 15 through 18, it says that these statements may not be used as evidence in a prosecution for a stalking, which is a crime as defined in 163.732, or for violating court stalking protective orders defined in ORS 163.750. There's nothing in this that would bar or prohibit the use of these statements in a perjury case because it is limited to those two criminal statutes. Thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody want to move these?
So, yes, Mr. Chair, I move the -A10 amendments, or the -10 amendments to House Bill 2177A.
Senator Walker moves the adoption of the A10 amendment to House Bill 2177. Is there further discussion? Any objections? No objection. Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2177 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2177 as amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? There's no objection. Motion passes. And let's see. Senator Rainbow, would you carry that for me? Lab 2. All right. 808. Do we want to get into that one?
Yeah.
Okay. work session, 8:08.
Sindel, 8:08. Is anyone here on 8:08?
Anybody care about 8:08?
Well, I cared about
8:08. Teresa says she cares about it. Really briefly, I'm going to find my amendments, I hope.
We're not at that part of the session where we do going once, going twice.
The dash two?
Yes, the dash twos. Thank you, Senator Walker. 8:08, we had this here hearing yesterday. This is a bill that I think was introduced by Kate Brown. Senator Brown was here yesterday. It was at the request of the Juvenile Rights Project. This deals with plans for transition to independent living for children who are in the custody or have been committed to DHS. What these amendments would do is they amend in Section 1 of the bill, they amend the statute that talks about what at a permanency hearing, and again, a permanency hearing is that hearing that the juvenile court conducts so that they make sure that they have a permanent plan for a child. This is federally has been the law where we don't leave children in abeyance. We have a plan for their permanent life, if they're going to be in foster care, if they're going to be adopted, if they're going to be given back to their parents. In those situations where the permanent plan is something other than reunifying with the family, this would set out a review by the court of that plan. There should be, you might have a memo from Virginia Vanderbilt. She had some concerns about how this was drafted, and I want to go through those real briefly and explain what I think the, I will say this, I think that this is drafted the way that the proponents of this want. I think that JRP worked with DHS on this. This would require a plan for any child who is at least 16 years of age, would require a review of the plan. Virginia's concern was that there doesn't seem to be a requirement that there be a plan to review, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But my understanding is, after talking from JRP, they believe that this will allow the court to orally review a plan and just talk about a plan at this hearing, so that I think their hope is that it will ensure that DHS is doing a plan to transition. So it would be for any child who's at least 16 years of age or a child who's at least 14 years of age, and there is a comprehensive plan for the child's transition to independent living. So I hope that makes sense. What Virginia's concern was is it makes it sound like these kids that are 16, it sounds like you're reviewing a plan that doesn't actually exist, if that makes sense. But I think that this is going to do what they want, which is make sure that there's a discussion about this. Nancy Miller is here, and she might have, I don't know if Nancy has any comments on 8:08. The second section, 419B343, this is the portion of the bill that deals with basically telling DHS that they have to look at this review and take into consideration the recommendations of it. And so you'll see on page 2, lines 13 to 16, they have to look at this and see if they can work on the plan which addresses the child's needs and goals for transitioning to independent living. These are the dash 2 amendments worked on with DHS. I think their first concern was, as originally we had it, it would have been having them to work up these plans for kids who are not getting close to the age where they would be possibly moving to independent living. So these put an age limit on it. That's what DHS wanted. And Nancy, I was saying briefly that Virginia raised some concerns about the way this was drafted for it makes it the kids that are at least 16, it makes it somewhat confusing in that there may not be a plan, or there's not a requirement that there is a plan for the court to review. And I just made it clear that I think that is understood by the parties, and that the idea was that this would at least let the court review an oral plan and a need for a plan if there wasn't one in place that DHS had written. Is that right?
Right. And Mickey Cerise, that's your understanding also?
Oh, Mickey is here. Sorry.
All right. Everybody's happy. Anybody want to talk to me about this?
Except for Virginia on
Virginia, we have
on TV. If she's she's waving her finger at the TV.
Well, I want to make some comments, Mr. Chair. So after the hearing we had earlier, I wrote a letter to Jean Thorne the director of DHS, because I was frankly quite appalled at the testimony I heard in committee from Mr. George, who said that there is a provision in place to develop a transition plan, but the department hasn't been good at it. I thought that was unacceptable and asked why the department hasn't been good at it. I got a letter back stating that they had a review by a federal review team, and the team identified Oregon in compliance with 75% of the cases. The national benchmark is 80. As a result of not meeting the benchmark, a program improvement plan was initiated by DHS to improve the standard, increasing training for caseworkers. I think this is really critical. We can't leave these youth hanging, and I'm hoping that what we've done in this bill is strengthen this provision to make sure we have independent living services in place for these youth. Because as was testified to at the hearing by the juvenile, Julie McFarlane from the Juvenile Rights Project, these kids are at a severe disadvantage for going to college, high unemployment rate, homelessness, and high pregnancy. So I just want to make sure that what we're doing is really what needs to be done here. And I'm just a little concerned about the things that Ms. Vanderbilt raised in her letter.
Okay. All right. Well, and the chair got a little bit ahead of himself here. We didn't post this until 9:15 yesterday morning, so we have to wait until 9:15 to meet our obligation, the 24-hour
okay.
rule. So we'll close the work session until 9:15, and we'll come back to it. Senator Starr, you have to be somewhere.
Yeah, for a few minutes.
For a few minutes. Okay, so we'll reconvene as a subcommittee for the purpose of hearing some public testimony on a number of bills. All righty. Let's... Yeah, let's get the bill up here. All right. Mr. Taylor. We're going to start the...
Council. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2101 provides contempt proceedings for violation of the Family Abuse Prevention Restraining Order for violations of the Elderly Abuse Prevention Act. Restraining order may be conducted in the county where violation restraining order has occurred. What we had heard in the House was testimony that the fact that you may have a situation where a woman has been subject of abuse by her spouse, and LeGrand moves to Portland, he follows, and she, to enforce the act, would have to return to LeGrand, and this would allow her to, for example, to bring up Multnomah County. I believe Mr. Niebel, among others, is here, as is Rebecca Grandy.
All right. Rebecca, is it Gandy? Why don't you come up? You signed up first. I don't know if Mr. Niebel wants to come up at the same time. There's plenty of room. You're not hostile towards each other. No restraining orders.
No restraining order.
Yeah. Chair Bettis, members of the subcommittee. I have a bad cold, so I hope you can understand me. My name is Rebecca Gandy. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and here in support of House Bill 2101. This bill will, I believe, my organization believes, will be very beneficial to victims who are the petitioners in FAPA and EDPAPA orders. If they do move to a different county, often they've moved to where there is more support, perhaps at a shelter or other program or where family members are, and if they could prosecute the violation where the person has moved to, then that support system may be more available in terms of transportation issues, child care issues, things like that. It could be easier for the victim if the violation could be brought where the victim is. Basically, I'm just here to answer any questions that you may have in terms of the victim perspective. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Niebel.
Mr. Chair, I'm David Niebel, today representing the Oregon Coalition to End Violence, Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women. I'm here to support House Bill 2101. This bill was filed by the Department of Justice to resolve the issue that Ms. Gandy has described, in which a Family Abuse Prevention Act order or an Elderly and Disabled Persons Abuse Prevention Act order is violated in a county different from the county of its issuance. The need for this bill arose from a Court of Appeals case, Bachman against Bachman, decided in 2000, that said that the context was a person who was actually restrained in Multnomah County by a Multnomah County order. The violation occurred in Washington County. He moved to have venue changed to Washington County so that the order could be prosecuted, or the contempt could be prosecuted there. And the Multnomah County, the Court of Appeals held that the proper venue was in Multnomah County. This cast doubt on the ability of Washington County or a similarly situated county district attorney's office to file cases in the county where the abuse occurred. This bill clarifies that either county is appropriate for venue. And so it's a small bill. It went through the House without opposition. It was a priority to resolve this issue among domestic and sexual violence victim advocates this session, and we urge you to pass this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Jonathan Fuster.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Oregon Department of Justice. And all I want to do is just echo what Mr. Neville and Ms. Gandy have said. We support this bill. All it does is give some flexibility to the system, enabling us to bring enforcement actions in the forum that is most convenient for the parties. It may even save a little money in the sense of eliminating the requirement to transport an in-custody defendant and all the witnesses from the place where the violation happened back to the original county that entered the order. I've submitted written testimony, and beyond that, I have nothing to add unless there are questions from members of the committee.
I want counsel to get me on track. A petition under 107.710 and a petition under 124.010. Two different petitions. Which
I think, they're both. I can't tell you right now.
Okay.
Mr. Fussman, could you answer that?
I'm not sure I heard the question. I'm
well,
sorry.
There's Section 2 and Section 4. One's a petition under 107.710. Section 4 is petition under 124.010. I just want to make sure what those petitions are.
Chair Minnis, I believe that the Family Abuse Prevention Act is 107.700 to 732, and the Elderly and Disabled Person Abuse Prevention Act is ORS 124. 0.005 to 0.040. Those are the two primary kinds of restraining orders that the bill addresses.
All right, then. And clearly we do not have a quorum, so we can't take action on the bill. So, all right, thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2101? Sounds like a great idea, but we don't have a quorum. There you go. All right.
It is a great idea, so let's bring it back.
And have we put out like an APB for Senator Ferrioli and the vice chair?
Huh.
Being a devil. Thank you. That was timely. All right. What's next up on the hit parade here? 2174. Public hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, it would be Phil Lemon. What this does approves the rules and amendments made by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission pursuant to its obligations under ORS 137-667. It does other clarifications concerning who can vote and who can't. And also, Mr. Chair, of the committee, because of a lawsuit contending that constitutional grounds challenging the sentencing guidelines because they're not published in Telco in the ORS but referred to us for approval. To be on the safe side, the commission has decided to include all its regs in the statute. We don't want to get a year from now to find out that we don't have sentencing guidelines because of the possibility of a successful constitutional challenge.
That's right. Mr. Lemon.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Phil Lemon, I'm the Director of the State Criminal Justice Commission. This is our biennial bill to ask you to ratify changes to the sentencing guidelines rules that respond to legislation that this body enacted in 2001. These rules will sunset unless the legislature affirmatively acts to approve them. I'm going to keep this at a fairly high level today. If you do have additional questions, there's obviously 44 pages worth of text there, and if you do have questions, I'd be glad to answer, but I'm just going to kind of hit the highlights. My testimony consists of three parts. The first is kind of a blow-by-blow that organizes the decisions that the commission made by the specific bill that you passed last session. The second piece is a table that is, I think, a little easier to understand what the decisions are. And then the third piece gives you a list of the changes by rule in which they occur. There are basically three kinds of decisions that the commission made and we are asking you to approve today. The first establishes the crime seriousness ranking for 26 newer modified felonies from the 2001 Legislative Assembly. And again, what that means is as you put these things on the grid, that establishes the presumptive sentence for people convicted of these crimes. The second decision is whether to designate these crimes as person crimes. The effect of that is to increase the sentence if the person gets convicted in a future proceeding, and that moves them across the grid and gives them a more severe sentence because the person crime has a greater severity as we count it toward the sentence if they do come back. The third is just general response to legislative directives, which are something that the legislature tells the commission to do, and legislative enactments, which are things that you do that involve the guidelines rules that we need to integrate in and bring back to you for your approval. With that, I would just like to point out that there are only about four or five bills where we had any dissenting votes either at our advisory committee level or at the commission level, so I'll just focus on those to give you an idea of where people did have some difference of opinion. Senate Bill 133 last session created two new felonies relating to felons either wearing or possessing soft body armor. We subcategorized that crime, which means that we found different levels of seriousness within that felony. It is a Category 6 crime if you wear body armor to commit a person crime, such as a robbery or an assault or a homicide. If you're not committing a person crime and possess body armor, that would be a Category 4 offense. So if you're down dealing drugs and you get popped and you're wearing soft body armor, then that is a less serious offense in our view. And so we subcategorize those to reflect that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Lemon, does that cover metal underpants?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I would have to read the definition again.
It's just a running joke in our committee. Thank you.
I understand. but we did have, the commission decided to put the Category 6 offense as a person crime, which again means if you come back into the system again, you would get a more severe sentence for your next offense because of your criminal history. There was a dissenting vote in that decision. Senate Bill 423 last session established a series of felonies related to cigarette tax violations. The Sentencing Guidelines Advisory Committee reduced them from a Category 2 to a Category 1 offense, and there was some disagreement on that. The Commission supported the Category 1 listing. And I would add that there in the bill that is currently going through the session now, House Bill 2368, creates a new series of cigarette tax-related felonies that we will be dealing with next session. House Bill 2646 elevated the Class A misdemeanor of assaulting a public safety officer to a felony. We have one member on advisory committee who traditionally dissents from a Category 6 ranking. The commission has supported any time you make a felony assault, elevate something from a misdemeanor assault to an assault 3 or Class C felony assault. For consistency purposes, that those be ranked at a 6. We have one member who consistently disagrees with that approach. Then finally, House Bill 3035 created felonies relating to applying controlled substances to minors. and those offenses are made person crimes under the guidelines rules, and we had one member dissent on that decision. The last issue I would just point out for you is in Section 4 of the bill, where we modify the statutory authority of the Commission to adopt guidelines rules. We have two legislative members on the Criminal Justice Commission who are non-voting members, and we amended the statute just to clarify that when the Commission has a majority vote to adopt these rules, that the legislative members do not count towards the quorum requirement to get to that majority, with all respect to Senator Minnis, who is a member. The other thing is that we, in the past, have erring on the side of caution, I think, have come back and asked you to ratify changes where we are translating chapter law numbers to ORS citations and making grammatical and non-substantive changes. The other change in that statute would allow us to make those and not bring those back to you for legislative approval. The final thing I would add, as counsel mentioned, is that there is a pending challenge in the Court of Appeals that contests the validity of sentencing guidelines rule changes based on their belief that the legislature should be required to review the full text of the guidelines rule amendments. In the past, we have just listed the rule numbers and asked you to ratify those changes by reference. The Attorney General's office advised us that they believe that that appeal will not be successful, but to be on the safe side, that they would like to see the full text of the rule set out in statute so all members have a clear understanding of what they are voting on and what they are approving. So that's a quick run-through of what this bill does, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Phil, talk to me about page 14, where it starts talking about sanctions and various custody units, I think, jails. So talk to me about that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Last session, the legislature passed House Bill 3461, which the general thrust of that legislation was to direct the commission to expand the number of jail and non-jail custody units available for probation violations. And the statute set out some broad parameters on how to approach that, and then we worked through our advisory committee with the Community Corrections Directors and Sheriff's Association to come up with that language. Basically what that does is allow more jail time and more non-jail custody units for probation violations, and sets that out for crimes committed on or after the effective date of the 01 legislation.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
That's fine. Actually, it kind of jars my memory from the 2001 session. One other question. The cigarette crimes that we've read, the felonies, what was the rationale of ranking it at a 1 category? I thought the purpose of the legislation was to go after people who are importing illegal cigarettes. At least they thought it was a fairly egregious organized crime type of activity, and Category 1 doesn't seem to mean much.
Mr. Chair, we consulted with the Attorney General's office in making those changes, since they're spearheading the Cigarette Enforcement Task Force. The most of the crimes, I think, that they expected to seek heavy penalties on are incorporated in the Racketeering Act, and so that kind of gives them the lever on the big players. The felonies that we were dealing with were, I think, more. There are a couple false reporting. Let me just look here real quick.
You know where that is in the Bill 2174? Wait. Page 37, I think.
The ranking of the specific offenses.
Yes.
And Mr. Chair, if you look on the table, in the table attached on my testimony, it's Senate Bill 423. The way these are characterized is distributing cigarettes without a license, false reporting to evade a cigarette tax, transporting without a permit. Those are, and again, after consulting with the Attorney General's office, the consistent theme was that those are appropriately Category 1 or 2 offenses, and so that's where we ended up ranking them. I haven't, the bill in session this time, which I think is House Bill 2368, it's down in House Revenue now, does, I think, establish felonies that are more aimed at the organizational aspects of people who are engaged in the business or the organized conduct of evading cigarette taxation. My understanding of these felonies was that these are are not intended to get at the organizational aspects, although I think it is attached to the RICO statute, so if people...
But RICO requires a predicate offense of some sort, doesn't
and
it?
And I believe all these are so predicates, Mr. Chair.
But, yeah, but so you'd have to capture them twice, I think.
Well, you would have to show that there is a pattern or practice of organized criminal activity, in which case you'd have to have at least two counts of false reporting or distribution or whatever the offenses are.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Good
question.
Mr. Chairman, I do issue that it's a relatively small issue but could cause lots of argument. People in the building can't agree between the word shall and may. And, you know, the sometimes sentence structure and grammatical construction change the ordinary meaning of sentences, and that will play out as challenges, at least in my mind, of what was the legislative intent or what does this really mean. And one of the places those get aired is in that feedback loop with the legislature as we do the biannual update of this statute. And so I was going to ask if I could hear a little discussion about who is going to be the arbiter of meaning when you make those grammatical and ordinary changes. And isn't that what we have the judges for and the legislators?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I think I understand your concern. What we're trying to do, we understand that you have limited time and that when we bring every single change that we're asking you or your staff to do a lot of proofreading in essence. And so this is our effort to kind of focus your attention on the policy decisions rather on the things that may not need your attention. The authority that the commission has given in this bill parallels the authority you give legislative counsel to make housekeeping non-substantive changes. And so just the process that we have is, I guess there are two layers of review. One is that after the commission adopts the rules, we send a copy of those rules to legislative counsel. The legislative counsel committee has a process where they compare the actions that the commission has taken against our statutory authority and other considerations, and they issue a report. And if they find that they believe we're acting outside our statutory authority, then we have that discussion with them. And then that would, I think, come back to you. If you are concerned about, but I guess I would just say that this parallels and actually is less than the authority that legislative council has to make changes. If you'd like me to get you a copy of that statute to see what authority LC has to make those kind of changes, I'd be glad to provide that to you.
Mr. Chairman, the issue for me isn't that I doubt that the process will be undertaken in good faith. The question for me is if what's at issue is the limited time of legislators, I'd just request the witness to turn 180 degrees and look at all the proofreaders we have. And if something is routinely coming to this legislative body for ratification, all these people that are engaged in this issue look at the stuff in those proposed statutes or changes in legislation that affect them. And so there's this automatic trigger for this discussion. I'm just concerned that if we do that sort of thing, essentially out of the venue that we have, then a lot of people will not be engaged. And if there's a difference of opinion between legislative counsel and the folks that are doing the judicial administration for these statutes, who settles that? And, you know, is there going to be, at that point, does somebody come running to the legislature and say there's an argument over the sentence construction?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, as my response to that would be that, as you can see from my testimony, we make decisions, the commission makes decisions on several dozen bills. And the ones where we had any dissent at all were limited to four or five. We have full participation from a variety of disciplines and professions in the criminal justice community, including the defense bar, community corrections, sheriffs, Department of Corrections, district attorney, and the court. We have a public process where we notify legislators who sponsor legislation that are involved in our rulemaking process. We have both a subcommittee, which is a public body. We have the commission, which is a public body. We have the LC process, which is a public review. I think there's a series of protections in here to prevent those things from happening. If there is a disagreement, I'm trying to imagine what kind of a decision that how that would come up. that we're making a substantive change in doing that. I think that would be raised early in the process.
I think the actual key here is that, I mean, that's why we have the rules come to the legislature, and that's why we have to do our due diligence. And now's the time, if we think it necessary, to make changes that we consider doing that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to speak for what the legislature intended, because in part I wasn't here and because in part I'm in the executive branch. But I think the purpose of having the legislative review of the guidelines rules is to review the policy changes and the substantive measures that the commission has recommended or adopted, and to bring that back and get your approval on them.
Correct.
Whether, you know, if you want us to keep drawing to your attention that we are changing, you know, the reference from 2001 Oregon Laws, Chapter 829 to ORS 163, whatever it turns out to be, then we can certainly do that. I mean, we have to do that work regardless, and it's a matter of convenience and what your comfort level is. If you want to keep reviewing that and have those changes be required to be reviewed by statute, then I have no problem with that.
I would agree that if the changes are not substantive changes, I don't know that I would have a problem with that either. The question is that even minor changes in the law tend to engender these discussions about what is and what isn't substantive. And so I guess I'm looking for more of an issue of resolution between those that some people will consider to be very substantive changes.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess I would just, if you look at the language in Section 4 of the bill, what that says is the commission may, without prior legislative approval, renumber the rules, change internal references to agree with the statute or rule numbers, delete references to repealed statutes or rules, substitute statute references for chapter numbers, etc., or correct manifest clerical, grammatical, or typographical errors. I mean, those are the kind of changes that we're trying to expedite. If you're not comfortable with that, then, again, this is not going to be a big sticking point for me. We're just trying to make the process work easier.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, those kinds of changes sound innocuous.
Okay. All right. Well, I think this organization, this particular group, Criminal Justice Commission, reviewing the work of the legislature and trying to fit everything into the matrix, I think they do a pretty good job given the complexity of the nature of their work. And I had the experience of actually sitting on that group that put this together back in the 80s. It was a mind-boggling endeavor. So.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't think we realize how many criminal laws we pass each session until the Criminal Justice Commission gets a hold of it and tries to fit it together.
Right. Phil, you do fiscal analyses on various crime categories. Are you now, are we tracking whether or not your predictions were accurate?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do.
Can you tell us, you know, how
our track record and how accurate
how
we are?
Doing and, right.
Yes, generally on the larger bills, the ones that create substantial prison impacts, we have pretty consistently been low. On bills that create primarily on the smaller numbers and those that create probation impacts, we have a mixed record. But that generally is fairly insignificant in terms of how the bill progresses through the process or whether money's appropriated or what the actual impact.
Right.
To give you a specific example, when we did the felony drunk drive estimate in 1999, we were very accurate in projecting the number of people going to prison under that law. The reason we were under in terms of the bed usage was that the people who ended up getting sentenced for felony DUI had a higher concentration, there were more repeat offenders, so they were more column A and column B people, or they got departure sentences that we had not been able to anticipate because of the contacts we made with the prosecutors and judiciary in our calls around. Identity theft is one that, you know, as you often hear, what's going to be the deterrent effect, how will that phase in, how are prosecutors going to use that? That's one that we, you know, put a couple disclaimers on because there were some very significant it's a wide range of discretion for prosecutors to have, and we noted that. And between, I think, the exercise of that discretion and the continued prevalence of ID theft and the broad definition of that crime, that many more people have come into prison than we had projected in our impact estimate. So, again, on the big bills, where it really, I think, makes a difference to this body in terms of the policy and correctional resources, we've consistently, I think, kind of undershot that.
Good. right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right. I think at this time we're going to close the public hearing and take a little time to digest it and make sure we're making a good decision. All right.
Mr. Chairman, is there no other testimony on the bill?
There is no other testimony.
If you want to move the bill, I can find
it. I'd like to hold on to it. Close the public hearing and let's see what's next on my hit parade. 2207.
Related to sentencing.
2207. Public hearing and.
Sentence construction.
Janet Tindall.
Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the State Parks and Recreation Department, and it authorizes them to request from state police criminal offender information subject to about subject individuals. As chair, members of the committee, the main change in the language, and probably the best place to start would be to look at page 5 under authorized agency. And what it does, currently, the Department of Human Rights Services or the Employment Division may receive this information. And what they did is write a definition of authorized agency to include those two departments plus the State Parks and Recreation Department.
All right. Ms. Tindall.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janet Tindall. I'm the Assistant Director for Administrative Services for the State Department of Parks and Recreation. And we do present this bill for your consideration this morning. It has come to our attention that we have on occasion had some employees or park hosts who have not had the most desirable background for serving in our parks, and this would allow us to do a background check on those individuals prior to them serving in those positions. And I've provided some written testimony, so I'll just kind of summarize the highlights of that. The Work in Progress Board, in their most recent approval survey, found that 93% of the public thought that Parks was doing a good job in terms of the work they do. We find that people feel very safe when they come to Parks. They allow their children to roam around the park, ride their bikes. We have programs that we offer for children. We have a junior ranger program that offers interpretive walks or activities for children where their parents are not present. And we also have a number of elderly or people with disabilities visiting our parks, and feel that we need to just ensure that the staff that we have at the park are providing good service and they are solid citizens in every way. So this will provide us with that opportunity.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on 2207? Committee members, have any problems with 2207? Work session 2207.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'd move House Bill 2207 to the Senate floor where it do pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2207 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? No objections? Motion.
Well, I just wanted to point out to the committee that the department is absorbing the cost within their current operating budget, so they don't need extra funds.
Motion passes. Thank you very much. And who wants to be a volunteer to carry this kind of piece of legislation?
Here, that one.
Senator Starr. Okay.
I think so.
All right.
Do you want to move something else before I...
No. We're going to take a 5-minute recess. Five minutes. The members wander back. Representative Backlund, you're here on 2422, is that correct? All right, so we'll do a public hearing on 2422 and allow your testimony so you can get about your business.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice of you to call me up and allow me to testify. House Bill 2422 is a bill that came out of the House Judiciary Committee with an 8-0 vote and was passed on the House floor with a 57-0 vote. So it was truly, it's my pleasure to be the chief sponsor of this bill. The bill was brought to me by Judy Smith, who is a member of the Kaiser City Council and has been a school crossing guard for some 5 years. When crossing guards and children are in a crosswalk, they must be protected. Drivers are accustomed to stopping when school buses are stopped. They see the flashing red lights. And they're well aware that there are kids or children in the area. And so I believe that no less should be expected when crossing guards are present in the crosswalk. Currently, cars do not really pay that much attention when they see a guard, a crossing guard in the crosswalk. They may well pay attention when they see kids. But I believe this is a good safety bill. It's a safety issue, I think, that should be addressed. And so I would urge that you pass House Bill 2422. And I would answer any questions, if I can, if you have any.
The only question that I have so far, Representative, is that how do you discern who the traffic patrol member is? It seems to be undefined.
Senator Menes, good question. I believe the crossing guard is well noted because the crossing guard will have a flag. Will be a very conspicuous flag and a sizable one at that, and so I think that would answer that question.
At least, assumedly, this is the person that has a soft flag or cross, something of that nature. Okay, the traditional sound. The council's going to look up and see if there might be a definition.
Okay.
So, all right, committee, House Bill 2422. Any questions, Representative Backlund? I don't believe there are. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much,
Judy Smith.
Good morning, Chair Menes and committee members. I'm here today to appeal to you to the protection of school crossing guards. I was a crossing guard for the Salem-Kaiser School District for almost 5 years. During this time, I feared for the students' lives as well as my own on many occasions. One of the problems that I frequently ran into was vehicles being allowed to enter the crosswalk while I was still standing in it. ORS 811.015, failure to obey a traffic patrol member, penalty. The driver of a vehicle commits the offense of failure to obey a traffic patrol member if, subsection B, the driver does not stop and yield the right of way to students who are in or entering the crosswalk from either direction on the street in which the driver is operating. If a vehicle does not stop or yield for students, said driver has committed a Class A traffic violation. But if the driver does not stop or yield for the crossing guard, there is no violation. In my experience, I can be standing out in the crosswalk with my flag out, and as soon as the students have reached the sidewalk, the cars start to pass me on both sides, making it almost impossible for me to get back to my station on the sidewalk. There have been times I may have stood out in the crosswalk for a few seconds after the students have reached the crosswalk, because in my experience, a student will turn around and want to run back home because of a forgotten backpack, lunch, project, or shoes when they're wearing their rollerblades. If the cars are allowed to pass me and a student turns around and darts back, there's a great possibility for an accident. Also, I have almost been hit on many occasions when the traffic starts going around me, impatient to get where they're going. There have also been instances when cars have stopped and the drivers have screamed obscenities out their windows at me for being in the way. The problem with ORS 811.015 came to my attention when an officer ticketed one of the vehicles for entering the crosswalk while I was still out there. The judge had no option other than to find the driver not guilty, due to the ORS only covering students. In talking with the City of Kaiser Police Traffic Unit, I discovered this has happened many times before, and due to the interpretation of the judge, other cases have been thrown out. I'm here today to plead for the safety of crossing guards all over the state of Oregon. It is not an easy job we do, and we would greatly appreciate any help to keep us safe as we try to protect the many students that we serve daily. This can be accomplished by amending ORS 811.015 to include drivers stopping and yielding to traffic patrol members, as well as students in the crosswalks. Thank you for your time and consideration in this matter of utmost importance.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions by the committee? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Could you gave several hypotheticals. Could you point to one or two that are already not covered by the law?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, a crossing guard is not covered by the law at all. The only ORSs that do cover anyone in the crosswalk are for pedestrians and students only.
Okay.
Because we are employees, we are not considered under those regulations.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to hold on to this bill for a little bit. We're going to see if we can come up with a fairly succinct and narrow definition of traffic patrol person so that it's not just any citizen who claims to be one. And make sure that we have a reference in statute that defines that. And with that, I think we'll close the public hearing. Unless there's anybody else who wants to talk about this one? There's not. Representative Backman, do you have other bills here?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, again, thank you. We'll close the public hearing then and move a. Well, it's after 9:15, so let's go back to 8:08. I think we have a quorum. We have an amendment in 808. Council, is that yours or something?
No, it's not, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Great. All right. Craig, is he anywhere around?
Friends.
Council Friends. Council Friends. Yes, sir.
Can I read here?
Of course you can. We'll reopen the public
Thank
hearing.
You. Just kind of an addendum here. Judy has handed me a photocopy, and it indicates that traffic patrol members described in this section are those provided under ORS 339.650 to 339.665. And I don't know if you've looked at those or not. But
we did, actually.
Oh, okay.
It just isn't very distinctive or clear. The individual, hopefully, as you said, was someone holding onto a flag or wearing a vest.
Maybe a uniform,
sort of,
yeah.
Something like that. Not necessarily a uniform, but something that distinguishes them. Mm-hmm. As a safety or traffic guard, and I think if we can clarify that, I think it'll make it very clear in prosecuting these cases that we know who's the subject of this. So.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you. All right, Council Friends, you're up, buddy. 808. So the dash two amendment.
Dash two amendment.
All right. We're in work session. 808.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 808.
Senator Starr moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 808. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? No objection. The motion passes. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 808 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr now moves Senate Bill 808 as amended by the committee to the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation. Is there any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? There's no objection. Motion passes. Senator Ferrioli, would you be so kind as to carry that?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. So that one is gone. Craig, do you have any more?
302.
302. Is that a fun one?
I don't know. I don't know. Not necessarily.
Is Mr. Fuller's not here yet, is he? Not yet. All right. Let's... Let's do 302 real quick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 302, you should have the dash 5 amendments before you. And also there's a fiscal impact statement that Ms. Christian has written. Briefly, this Senate Bill 302 deals with DUII diversion. And we heard some testimony. Diversion works... I'll try to give you a thumbnail sketch. Certain people are eligible for diversion. First-time offenders, people who don't have a pending charge for DUII, people who have not caused an injury in an accident are eligible for diversion. It's a first-time thing. You have a diversion agreement that you go in through. You agree to pay for the alcohol and treatment, and you go through the diversion. If you successfully complete diversion, you don't have a conviction, and on your traffic record, it will show a diversion, but it won't. You know, you won't have a DUII. So then, that's obviously very nice for people to be able to do that, because then you won't have a conviction. We talked about this, and this bill would change the law on that so that you'd have to plead guilty to get into the diversion, and then the judge would hold that guilty plea and would not enter the judgment and wait for you. And if you successfully complete, there would not be ever any conviction entered. If you fail diversion, then this would allow for the case to be resolved at that point, because then you just have to enter the conviction. The Dash 5 amendments do the following. They incorporate things that several people wanted. The first one, if you look at the Dash 5s on page 13 to 15, this makes it clear that diversion, there's a 30-day window after you've appeared during which you have a choice about entering diversion. This makes it clear that for purposes of this diversion in this paragraph, you don't get more time so that you can litigate pretrial motions. And that would be, I think Mr. Marquis talked about that, and this was in the original bill, but we changed the original bill so that the judge still has, you know, all of the discretion about giving good cause and things like that. This kind of went back to that language, but that is originally in the statute, but clarifies that good cause should not include time to file those pretrial motions. The other thing it does, and I think this was at Ann Christian's request, was that it allows you to either enter a guilty plea or a no contest plea. And this would allow you to enter the no contest plea. I can see why that might be helpful, because in DUIs, people are intoxicated, and sometimes they don't remember things all that well. And so this allows them to say, yes, the state has this evidence. I'm not going to contest it, and I understand that I will be found guilty. But I'm not going to have to stipulate to facts that I was intoxicated. And then the other portion of this has to do with court-appointed attorney's fees, and I think this is what we had most of the discussion about. And briefly, what we did is we wanted to treat DUI diversion like any other case where a court appointed an attorney. And because now there's going to be a guilty plea, there will be attorneys. I think the understanding is there'd be an attorney on all of these cases. The current practice is different in every county, but many counties already do appoint attorneys as you enter into diversion. I talked to Doug Bray in Multnomah County. That's the practice. Whenever anyone requests an attorney, they usually get one. That started because they were concerned about people who maybe didn't speak English that well and things like that, and it kind of progressed from there. There's also a time in a DUII case where if you have not completed your DUII diversion alcohol treatment within a year, you have to go before the judge in a good cause type hearing and show the judge why you should stay in diversion. And at that type of hearing, you would get you'd have to enter the same guilty plea that we'd be putting in on all diversions. And in those cases, they would also be, the judges are going to be already appointing attorneys. What this amendment makes clear is that the defendant shall pay the court any court-appointed attorney's fees agreed to under the diversion agreement. Payments shall be made prior to the end of the diversion period, and the court may waive all or part of the court-appointed attorney's fees agreed to. And that's the same as any other criminal case when there is someone who the judge finds cannot pay the attorney's fees. So that's the Dash 5 amendments. Countless Sugar's here, Josh Marquis here, the Pratts are here, Ms. McKenzie's here from the Governor's Task Force, Ann Christian's here, Susan Russell's here. So if there's any, I don't know if there's any.
Everyone's here.
Everyone's here. I think that the issue, there is the fiscal. It hasn't gone to LFO yet, so we don't have an actual fiscal statement. So, Mr. Chairman, you could send this to the floor or to Ways and Means. The fiscal that came from Judicial Department has a $131,000 estimated in this biennium. But I should say that it hasn't gone to LFO yet, and I'm sure that, I know that Mr. Marquis, it went to it, we just don't have it returned. Mr. Marquis would like an opportunity to talk to LFO about it, so just want to let you know all those. That's kind of the background.
All right, great. Senator Ringo.
I just had a comment for you, I guess. I, I don't know where you're intending to go with all these people who want to testify, but I'd be interested in hearing the defense lawyers again express their opposition.
You just like hearing them do that, don't you?
Well, I would be interested in that.
Okay, good.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
I'm sorry, I missed the discussion about the amendments. I had a note, a sticky note on my file that I can only support this bill if we keep the extension request with the court.
Yeah.
And only require payment of attorney fees if you fail diversion. Do we need those?
Mr. Chairman, Vicki Walker, Senator Walker. Sorry. On the first one, sorry. On the first question, the good cause is still in the court's hands.
Okay.
On the second one, you would have to pay attorney's fees if you fail, or, I mean, it would be if you fail diversion or you are successful in diversion, but it would be the same way you pay attorney's fees on anything, meaning the court can waive any or all of it if they find that you truly cannot pay even that court-appointed attorney fee.
All right. Anne, I want to have you come up and just chat with us about the fiscal and the assumptions underlying the cost, if you would.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anne Christian, and what I've provided to the committee members is a fiscal impact statement. I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm here today in the role of Indigent Defense Services Division Director, the Judicial Department, in part because I was responsible for coming up with the fiscal on the public defense side. Judicial Department has not yet completed the fiscal impact statement for the courts. And, Mr. Chair, I would like to start by saying in 1995, a similar bill to Senate Bill 302 was introduced. And at that point in time, the indigent defense impact that was projected as a result of that very, very similar bill was $1.6 million. That was back in 1995. Two things have changed since 1995 that lessen the fiscal impact statement that you have before you. One of them is the fact that in 1997 the legislature did require that anyone who is in the DUII diversion program who is requesting additional time past 1 year to complete that program must enter a guilty plea. The second thing that has changed since 1995, and this was referenced by Mr. Prinz, is that we have found more and more courts appointing counsel at the beginning of a DUII case, in a DUII case that is diversion eligible. In 1995, that rate was 12.5% based upon a survey that was done in 1993. And today, as is included in the fiscal impact statement, and we've relied on Multnomah and also surveyed some other counties, the rate of appointment of counsel in DUII diversion cases is almost 35%. So it's increased threefold since 1995. For purposes of this fiscal impact statement, Mr. Chair, I've made a number of assumptions, and at the end of the fiscal, I did feel compelled to state that based upon my experience, this fiscal is indeed conservative. The assumptions I made are that, number one, that the Multnomah County rate of appointment of counsel on DUII diversion eligible cases is the norm for the state. In the survey that we did, the responses range from 10% of the DUII diversion eligible cases the courts would appoint counsel, 10% to 40% to 50% in a county that is middle size. So I use the assumption that currently counsel is being appointed in 35% of the cases anyway, and there would be no additional fiscal impact. The second assumption I made is that a greater number of people than average, on average, retain counsel on DUII cases. And from the Multnomah query, that percentage of cases, diversion-eligible cases, where an individual retains counsel is 23%. The total number of DUI cases are about 20,000 a year, over 11,000, so over 50% of those DUI cases are diversion-eligible cases. It's a pretty good-sized pool of cases. And so I assume that currently we're appointing, the courts rather are appointing, and we are paying for counsel in 35% of the diversion-eligible cases. And then the difficulty with a fiscal is trying to make assumptions as far as what will happen with regard to individuals who currently do not have one of two things, current court-appointed counsel or retained counsel. And what I assumed was 10% of those people who currently go through the system and decide on their own whether to submit a petition for DUII diversion, I assume that 10% of those would continue to go through the system with absolutely no counsel whatsoever, whether retained or not retained. I also assumed that of the remaining individuals, the same proportion of those individuals who currently are going through the system without the assistance of counsel, that the same percentage would retain counsel and the same percentage would be appointed counsel by the courts. And with those assumptions and the one additional assumption that there may be, and many defense attorneys believe this, some judges believe it, I don't know anymore whether I believe it, but there is a potential that an individual who is charged today with DUII, who can enter diversion without entering a guilty plea, if charged with DUII after Senate Bill 302 is enacted, might not enter into diversion. And I assumed 5% may not. In part, Mr. Chair, that 5% is based upon the fact that this Dash 5 amendments do include a provision that an individual can enter a plea of no contest, which is counsel, as counsel pointed out, does result in the same result, which is a conviction of DUII if someone does not complete diversion. So that is the those are the assumptions under my fiscal impact statement. I have not seen fiscals, for example, from the district attorneys, or I know Mr. Marquis had indicated that he had done some rough calculations with regard to police overtime. But this is a fiscal that certainly will be critiqued, I have no doubt. And I've indicated to both Ms. Sugar and Mr. Marquis that as they have comments, as we did this morning, I would be more than happy to discuss the assumptions with them.
All right, good. Josh, do you want to come up and chat about this issue? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association who sponsored the bill. I've also just got the fiscal this morning from Ann. She was kind enough to give it to me and explain a little bit. I don't know that there is the fiscal that relates to indigent defense, and Ann would know that probably better than me, although I've anecdotally the assumption that only 35% of the people are appointed counsel now seems low from what when I've spoken to Multnomah County DAs. Kamala Sugar is a deputy DA on the ground, and she goes to arraignments a lot. Her impression was that it was a larger number. So that, and I understand Ann didn't have that much time, and she took what she got from Multnomah County and tried to extrapolate it. It's my expectation and my understanding of talking to DAs that judges, for perfectly good reasons now, are appointing, and the more that they appoint lawyers now, the less the fiscal impact.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Of course. The other thing that I'm concerned about, and we can address it legislative fiscal, is the fact that currently, in some counties like mine, there's a lot of litigation that goes on for diversion-eligible cases. I brought a file. I just litigated. This is a 17-year-old kid who blew a .13, was a slobbering drunk in October, was given the opportunity to file motions. We went through 3 days of hearings, and 2 days ago the judge ruled that the stop was good, and now he's entering diversion. And that brings the issue about the global fiscal. The real dollar savings in this bill is to police overtime. I'd estimate it to be conservatively $1 million over the biennium. We're talking about DUI cases are litigated in motion more than any other kind of case. And as Ms. Christian says, an unusually large number of people get lawyers in those cases, and that's because DUII is probably the most democratic crime of all. You know, doctors, lawyers, butchers, bakers, Indian chiefs, everybody gets arrested for this offense. And there is a group of people, a small subgroup of the defense bar, some of whom are friends of mine, who I think feel strongly about this, and they're primarily those who do retained work. And this would cut down on their income because people would have, when they come in the door, and they blew a 1-5, and they're slobbering drunk, they'd have to make a choice. It could be, it should be a counsel choice. I don't have a problem with that. But I think the overall fiscal of this bill is highly positive.
The $1 million that you're assuming, speculating, that's all police agencies across the state?
It would be distributed, Mr. Chair, it would be distributed between probably state police, sheriff's offices, and city police departments, with most of the savings accruing probably to sheriff's deputies and local police departments.
Right. Okay. And the assumption is that the officers wouldn't have to attend the pre-trial motions.
Well, and more importantly, they wouldn't have to attend the trials, because if this bill is passed, they're simply, if a person entered diversion, there would not be a trial. And there's a significant number of trials, and it's getting worse as the jail resources get less, because I've been a defense attorney. If I had a guy say, well, if we can litigate it, let's do it, because you're not going to get any more than 2 days in jail on your second one anyway. So let's take a shot. Maybe the jury will find you not guilty.
I've had some weird jury verdicts before. You kind of go, where did that come from? Anyway, good. I think you want to hear from the defense bar. Okay. And Susan, you want to come up and chat? Might as well get everybody kind of engaged in this discussion.
Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm the chair, members of the committee. We had testified strongly in opposition of this bill, and we remain in strong opposition to the original bill and the amendment. It is our position that the current diversion program works. It's probably one of the most or more successful programs in the state. And I believe it, just on Mr. Marquis' statistics, and he can refresh my recollection, but I remember his testimony to be something that it's sort of a 60-70% success rate in his county alone. I don't think you'll find another program that has such a high success rate. So in our position, what we're doing is changing the fundamental rules of a program that has worked and has done the community a great deal of good. Under current law, a defendant must plead guilty to continue or stay in diversion after 1 year period of time. If you remember, one of Mr. Marquis's problems with this, the current law was this idea that there is a delay and it's difficult sometimes for the state to get its witnesses together or to prosecute a case when it's sort of stale. In particular, if a defendant fails to appear at some point in the diversion. We talked about that originally and pointed out that is a problem for the state in all contexts. It's not one that's isolated for DUI diversion programs. The defendant, in order to stay in the DUI program, must plead guilty within a year. When people fail out of a DUI diversion program, and again, Mr. Marquis can have his own I don't know if he would disagree, I doubt it, that people tend to fail out pretty quickly. People don't engage in drug or alcohol treatment. People don't show up for their scheduled court appearances. A show cause hearing is warrant is issued, and they're terminated. So that case would be the defendant may be in warrant status or abscond status, but again, that's no different in terms of other areas.
Mr.
Chair? Senator Ringo.
I guess I'd like to ask the question that I'm focused on. And if 60-70% succeed, that means 30-40% fail. And that's a large failure rate. And I understand you're essentially making the argument that the current system works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it is working pretty well, but if we can make it work better, then that's a good thing. And I'm just wondering, what is the What is the danger of doing this? What is the problems that this bill would cause?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, in my opinion, there would be a number. One, we have the expenses, and I believe that the expenses are actually conservative. Ms. Christian has not included in that all the investigative expenses that would be required. And so when we're talking about a system that's already taxed financially, to have such a huge indigent defense cost, and it's going to be greater than that, and an additional court cost and increased trials.
Sure. So is that your primary objection, then, is expense?
Ms. Chair, Senator Riggle, there's two. One is it's going to be cost, and then the other one, I think, is going to be that it's going to be undue delay. When we talk about this, I think Mr. Marquis, the proponent here, is coming forward with sort of the idea being is that by requiring a guilty plea, that's going to expedite things. Things will move faster. In fact, I think it won't. It'll be the opposite. As a defense attorney, all defense attorneys that will be appointed on these cases, in order for a defendant to enter a plea of no contest or guilty, all defense attorneys are under an ethical and constitutional requirement to investigate the case. People will, right now, without attorneys or without attorneys for the most part, are entering into diversion programs quite quickly, with the idea being is that they're not required to enter a guilty plea. They're not waiving their constitutional rights to eventually require a jury trial if they... I mean, so those things aren't being done, and so the investigation, even when an attorney is appointed, isn't going to be what it will be now. A scene will have to be investigated. Witnesses will have to be experts. This is an area where there's a huge complex motion practice that will have to be done. So rather than people going in quickly to diversion, getting in the alcohol and drug treatment that they need, I think what you're going to be seeing is cases that will take maybe 6 months of investigation before a person, an attorney, is in a position to be able to waive off.
Under this bill, a person would need to make that choice fairly soon, whether to plead guilty or not guilty. How much time from, say, the incident, the arrest, to that choice, how much time is there?
Well, I believe, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, under the current amended bill, it's 30 days unless good cause. And
so,
you're
saying that 30 days isn't long enough?
60 days.
It was.
Correct, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe it was 30 days under the original. It's now, the current statute is 30 days. The Senate Bill 302 was originally drafted, extended that to 60 days.
Okay.
I believe that it is good cause, given the changes in the law, the requirement of a guilty plea, and a waiver of the right to present any constitutional arguments, motion practice, that...
I'm sorry, I'm just focusing on your investigating issue.
Yes.
Right now.
No, I believe
the defense lawyer needs time to investigate the situation. Under this bill, would it be 30 or 60 days?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, there would be 60 days... but there can be a showing of good cause, and I guess what my response is that I believe those no.
I don't want to get confused. Senate Bill 302, Susan, the original bill was going to change it to 60 days, and it would have put the discretion more in the DA's.
Okay.
This changes it. It's going to be 30 days. It's going to be the judge's call, so it's going to be the same as the statute. All it's going to say is good cause does not constitute time to file these suppression motions, omnibus motions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just
go ahead.
I'm just trying to understand. I mean, you're throwing a lot of different things in here, so I'm trying to focus on one at a time. But one of them was there's not enough time for the defense attorneys to investigate. And so I'm trying to find out how much time is there under this bill, and I think the answer is at least 30 days. Right? And you think 30 days is too short.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riggle, I think it's an impossibly short period of time to investigate. When we talk about arraignments, that's an impossible time frame in which an attorney can fulfill his or her obligations.
But Susan, isn't that the argument you would make in front of the judge for more time?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I maybe haven't said this all quite so articulately in sort of a roundabout way. I guess what my real argument is that because under the amendment it would be 30 days, but there's also good cause. And what I believe is that a defense attorney ought to succeed in, and will succeed in, arguing to a judge that there is good cause to extend beyond 30 days, where there is now a requirement that the defendant enter a guilty or no contest plea, and a requirement that the defendant waive his or her constitutional rights. And therefore, what we're going to get into is a situation, instead of having people that are driving and are driving drunk or under influence of narcotics going quickly into a diversion program, a defense attorney is going to be able to succeed in arguing to the court that they need months in order to investigate and determine these issues and hire experts. And this is an area where, in terms of advising someone to plead guilty or not, it would be ineffective assistance of counsel not to examine, for example, the breathalyzer and the records of the breathalyzer. There may be drug or alcohol testing. There may be witnesses. There are often witnesses in these kind of cases. There's witnesses in terms of where the defendant consumed alcohol. There are forensic experts that will determine under the scenario what, when breath tests or blood tests aren't involved, what conduct is indicative of being under the influence of intoxicants? What is the metabolism rate? So I guess what I'm saying is that this bill is going to actually sort of defeat the proponent's purpose, which is to get these people into a diversion program quickly and keep them off the streets from drinking and driving. So I guess I find that that's our number one problem, is that we have a diversion program because people, for first-time offenders and DUIs, we believe as a society and a community that the emphasis should be on the treatment. And by making guilty pleas and having them waive their constitutional rights, we're now going to be changing that so that it's really about the conviction and having people assess the merits of case and make those determinations rather than getting them quickly into the program.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, it seems to me that the opposite is true, that you're focused on whether the breathalyzer might be subject to a constitutional challenge, mm-hmm. which doesn't go to the core issue as to whether the person drank too much before they got behind the wheel. And if the person did drink too much before they got behind the wheel, then they need treatment. And this is a mechanism to encourage them to get that treatment, to sign up and say, yes, I need that treatment, without waiting to find out whether their challenge to the breathalyzer succeeds or not.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
hang on a second. I get to be the chair. I get to do this. This is fun. Senator Ringo, I'd like to adopt the amendment and send it to Ways and Means, but I don't know where the committee is.
I'm a bleeding heart liberal, and I am all over this bill. It's fine with me.
Just sure.
Senator Farrell.
It seems to me that the issue really is a very successful program that seems to operate at a 60 or 70% efficiency. And I absolutely believe that if you require the guilty plea at the front end of this process, you'll incent more people to go through the diversion program successfully, because they know that it isn't a matter of going back to their attorney and looping through the process and delaying the process and hoping the witnesses scribble away, or that the police officers are too busy or too overwhelmed to go again and again and again to court. Instead of that, what you'll have is a judge who says, you will do this diversion as you've agreed to do it, or you will do the time for the DUI. And those are vastly different sets of equations than the current situation, where delay is a possibility, obfuscation is a possibility, and the bottom line is that the public pays not only in terms of the cost, but in terms of the risk of reoffense.
Work session.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senator
as the amendment.
Farioli moves the -5 amendment to Senate Bill 302. Further discussion by the committee? Any objections by the committee? No objection. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill as amended to the floor for the defense record.
I would suggest we send it to Ways and Means.
Okay, fine. Mr. Chairman, I amend my motion to move the bill as amended to the full Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. Senator Farioli now moves the Senate Bill 302 as amended. He referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any further discussion? Mm-hmm. So the due pass recommendation to Ways and Means.
As amended.
I think that's appropriate.
Any objections to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Thank you very much for your time. Okay, now we have just a couple of minutes here. 103, public hearing 103. This is a bill that came from the business committee. The chair had some interest in this, and apparently it was the amendment that was dropped off.
My committee?
Yes, I believe so. Gentlemen, if you would, just introduce yourself for the record and tell us what you need to tell us.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Eugene F. Ebersole. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I've been with the Consumer Protection Financial Fraud Section for the last 14 years. I made some changes to this bill, originally, and brought it to the Senate because the original bill had some problems. Originally, this bill was passed because there was a practice that was perceived to occur where a consumer would go in to purchase a vehicle, they'd put a down payment and a trade-in on a car, and they'd enter into a proposed contract at a given interest rate. What was occurring was that the consumer then was not qualified for the given interest rate. Their trade-in would be gone. They'd come back to the dealership and have this onerous burden that they had to enter into a new contract with a higher interest rate. So this bill, which has a proverbial title, anti-bushing, I don't know where that came from other than we bootlegged it from the state of Washington, attempted to fix that bill. Over the course of the years, I worked predominantly in the motor vehicle enforcement industry. I wrote the administrative rules, and I worked with Mr. Fuller from the Oregon Dealers Association, Mr. King from the Oregon Independent Dealers Association. There was a problem that had occurred because of some not loopholes, but just some oversight in the original drafting of the bill, and that was that the original bill allowed the dealer to get rid of the trade-in car when the loan was approved. Unfortunately, a lot of banks send out these tentative loan approval letters almost the inception of the first contract, which gives the dealer the right to get rid of the car. Then, subsequently, somebody in the bank did some checking and comes back and says, oh, no, we want to revoke that approval. The dealer, based upon a good faith reading of the statute, would have gotten rid of the trade-in. They may have overpriced the trade-in to try and get an equity position for the consumer. And now they either have to give the consumer a lot of money, more than the trade-in's worth, to unwind the deal, or the consumer is now forced to put into another contract again at a higher interest rate.
And we have an A4 amendment to the bill. That's correct.
There is a new amendment to the bill, yes.
Let's chat about that real quick.
Where the bill is at now is that it is corrected in the position where if the loan, the trade-in can now only be gotten rid of by the dealer after a final loan approval for funding has been granted. There is also a provision in the bill to encourage the dealers to move the process along quickly. The original bill allowed a mileage charge to be incurred to the consumer if the deal didn't go through and the car went back to the dealership. Now the dealer, if they don't get the deal, the original deal consummated at the original interest rate in 20 days, they have to send a letter to the consumer telling them the transaction didn't go through and bring the car back. If they do not do that within the 20 days, they are not allowed any longer to charge that mileage fee. So there is a strong incentive now for the dealers to move this transaction along much more quickly, or else they don't have the ability to charge that mileage fee as well. And that's where the A. Engrossed amendment came in. It was left out by legislative counsel when this came from Business and Labor.
Okay. All right. Do you have any questions? Senator Ringo?
I thought in most of these transactions that the system was set up to allow for instant approval or non-approval one way or the other.
It's a great concept in its thought process, and it works in most cases. An average consumer that has a good credit rating, you score them what they call a beacon score. If you have a beacon score of, say, and it goes up to like 800, it's kind of like an SAT score in your college tests. If you have a 650 or better beacon score, the odds are very likely that you will get approved at what the original interest rate was quoted to you. Unfortunately, there are more than sufficient situations that occur where the people are below that 650 and the original interest rate does tend to rise from what was originally quoted by the dealer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, excuse me. A lot of these approvals are done based on computer scoring, as Mr. Ebersoling indicated. And what happens in a small number of cases in the lower credit rating area is the banks will actually do some checking on the contract, verify employment, verify income, and if it comes back that they reported that their income was X but they're making Y, or they say that they were employed at the same place for 5 years but they've only been there for 3 years, then the bank's conditional approval can sometimes be withdrawn based on inaccurate information provided by the consumer or other information that they discover during that process. And they're allowed to take the vehicle out on the conditioned approval. And under the current law, we're not allowed to sell their trade-in until we get final approval from the financial institution. And if we can't do that and we have to get them to bring the vehicle back because we can't get approval, and they don't want to buy the vehicle at a higher interest rate, and so we ultimately get the vehicle back, we're allowed to charge them essentially a mileage fee for the time they had the vehicle. And this limits that mileage fee to 20 days, essentially. And if we don't tell them that the deal hasn't been bought within 20 days and get the car back within 20 days, then we can't charge them the mileage. What that does is prevents a dealer from sending a customer out on a car that they know they can't buy them at that interest rate, and then just extend them out for a long period of time, bring them back 60 days later, and charge them so much for the mileage that the consumer is essentially forced into a higher contract because they can't afford to pay the mileage fee. So by limiting it to only 20 days, the consumer isn't put in a position where they owe so much in mileage that it becomes an onerous burden for them to return the vehicle.
Another question?
The 20 days is 20 days during the first 20 days the buyer in possession of the motor vehicle. Is there a time period by which the financing must be finally approved?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, ultimately there is not a final must be done by certain date. Dealers essentially have a gun to their head at 20 days because if we don't perfect the security interest within 20 days and the purchaser files bankruptcy, then we're not protected under bankruptcy law if we don't protect the third party lien within 20 days. So it would be far less than a fraction of 1% of the deals that would ever go beyond that 20 days, but there is no statutory limitation that says it must be done in X number of days.
Okay. Senator Ringel, that was in the original drafting of the bill to have a drop-dead date to get the car back by, but that was we negotiated that down with the industry, and we feel that this is a very good compromise. Because it doesn't give a definite drop-dead date, but what it does do is it very much encourages the dealer, I think, for the consumer's benefit to get that deal done, because they're obviously not going to want a consumer driving around in their vehicle for 3 months.
All right. Let me see. Anybody have any heartburn to the bill? Okay. We're going to do a work session on 103.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 103.
Senator Walker moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendment. Is there any discussion of the Dash 4 amendment in addition to what's been testified to? No additional discussion. Any opposition? No opposition. Motion passes. Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 103 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 103 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion?
I saw this in Business and Labor. It was a good bill then. Better bill now.
Better bill now. Okay. No objection. Motion passes. Senator Mark will carry. I've got one other issue. House Bill 2101.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. 2101, we heard we didn't have a quorum here to send it out.
Come on.
There are no amendments to the amendment.
That's correct.
Work session 2101.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill or a House Bill 2101 to the floor unamended. There was no amendments, right?
Right.
With a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves House Bill 2101 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation unamended. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Motion. There is none. Motion passes. Thank you very much. And just as you know, we're going to try to find some additional time in the afternoon or evenings in this next several weeks to try to get a little bit more of our work done, if possible.
Okay.
Afternoon is better.
Okay. So we're adjourned. Thank you.
I concur.
One chair.
Mr. Chairman, very well.
Okay.
Senator Perry only brought us all
pie. Did you pass out 808?
Yeah. Brought us what?
A pie.